Exchanges, the Goldman Sachs podcast featuring exchanges on rates, inflation, and U.S. recession risk. Exchanges on the market impact of AI. For the sharpest analysis on forces driving the markets and the economy, count on Exchanges between the leading minds at Goldman Sachs. New episodes every week. Listen now.
Welcome to Tech News Briefing. It's Tuesday, November 19th. I'm Belle Lin for The Wall Street Journal. Forget bars and boardrooms. Techies are starting to take their meetings and networking events in saunas. What's behind this hot Silicon Valley trend? We'll find out. And then President-elect Trump's second term could bring about huge changes to the top U.S. cybersecurity agency. Our reporter, James Rundle, tells us why it's facing criticism from some lawmakers and how it could change in the new administration. But first, tech founders and investors are no strangers to experimentation. And the newest trend they're latching onto? Networking inside saunas. Those hot, sweaty, enclosed spaces, best known as areas to relax and get away from work. For more on what's behind this trend, we're joined by WSJ reporter Angel Au Young. So, Angel, why saunas?
I was told that there is an anti-alcohol movement that's sweeping through the tech industry, and it's making investors and founders and employees just hungry for gathering places outside of bars or restaurants where the typical activity would be drinking or eating. And so one answer to that has been these social saunas. And these saunas can fit anywhere from 20 to 90 people, depending on the facility. And yeah, it's become a bit of a trend. It does seem like it skews on the younger end. The events that I saw and reported on, the age differences range from late 20s to 50s.
Where does this sort of anti-alcohol movement come from?
In general, it all relates to Silicon Valley's obsession with biohacking and trying to hack your own body in different ways to make yourself more efficient. Efficiency is a big theme in Silicon Valley. That's partially tied to why people are just turning away from alcohol.
So based on folks you've spoken with, how effective is sauna networking?
It seems like for the people who have been invited to these type of events, it has become a really good networking opportunity. But what investors have told me is that it's also a way to get to know founders, both from a professional standpoint and a personal level.
Very personal.
Right. And when I say personal, I mean, because you're not in a conference center or a bar where everybody's in a suit, you can ask questions like, what is your family like? Do you have kids? And the founder that I spoke to, who ended up taking a first founders meeting at a sauna, she told me that she got to know that the founder, who's also a woman, she had kids, and they were able to talk about family life in a way that the sauna supported. At the end of the day, if it is a first founders meeting, you are meeting them probably in some kind of swimwear. And these saunas can get obviously very hot. And so when you're meeting somebody for the first time and you've got sweat dripping down your face, I can see that being an obstacle in and of itself. But if you are an investor and you find a founder who is open to having a first founders meeting at a sauna, then maybe there is an interesting synergy there that could result in some kind of an investment. But it definitely takes getting used to, and it's definitely not for everyone.
So where do you think this is all going? I know we talked about the underlying anti-alcohol movement driving the move towards these alternative networking and social events. Do you think we'll see more sauna-type events pop up?
We're still pretty early stages with this trend. These types of social saunas have popped up this year in San Francisco, LA, New York, Boulder, which are tech hotspots. And one of the investors that I spoke to for this story, he said that there's always going to be a scenario where somebody's going to feel uncomfortable regardless of what the activity is. But right now, saunas are taking off because new facilities have just popped up. There just hadn't been good saunas for people to plan these types of work events at. So it could take off,
That was our reporter, Angel Au Young. Coming up, the nation's top cybersecurity agency could see some big changes in President-elect Trump's second administration. We'll find out what that could look like after the break.
Turning an idea into a small business doesn't happen by accident. You need to be all in. At Constant Contact, we have the digital marketing tools you need to get the word out, close the sale, raise the funds, and gather a community around this thing you've built. So let's do this together. Let's send this, share this, and shout this from the rooftops. Let's segment this, automate this, and AI this for real results fast. Let's get out of this what we put into this. Let's build this. Let's grow this. Let's win this. Get started today at ConstantContact.com.
The Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, or CISA, faces an uncertain future in President-elect Trump's second term. Criticism of the agency, which was created by Trump in 2018, has come from Republican lawmakers, Project 2025, and corporate cybersecurity executives. And just last week, Trump appointed Tesla CEO Elon Musk and former Republican presidential candidate Vivek Ramaswamy to lead an initiative to cut government spending and restructure federal agencies. WSJ reporter James Rundle tells us how CISA could change under the new administration and why various groups have criticized it for overreach. So, James, what are some of CISA's responsibilities?
So CISA is the primary federal agency responsible for cybersecurity among civilian branch agencies in the government. So everything basically outside of DOD. It's responsible for coordinating between them, making sure they have the appropriate protections in place and they're all secure from hackers. But it also has a number of ancillary roles as well. It's responsible for interfacing with the 16 critical infrastructure sectors, which includes things like telecommunications, gas, energy, the financial services sector. And it also has a very, very important role in election security as well. CISA doesn't just handle the cybersecurity aspects of that, but it also handles an element of physical security as well. There have been a lot of criticisms from lawmakers around President-elect Trump over the past few years around CISA, around its role specifically in disinformation, which has become something of a lightning rod for criticism from a number of congressional Republicans, not least of all Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky, who is now taking over as chair of the Senate Committee on Homeland Security and Government Affairs, which is CISA's primary overseer.
And what is President-elect Trump's history with CISA?
In a word, it's complicated. So Trump stood up the agency himself back in 2018. It was his creation, but over the first couple of years, it was a bit of a rocky relationship. And it came to a head in the 2020 election when its first director, Christopher Krebs, came onto Twitter, now X, obviously, and said there was no evidence of election tampering or fraud or anything of the sort. And Trump famously fired him by tweet. And since then, Trump hasn't said too much about CISA. He's let a lot of the lawmakers I spoke about do the talking. There were also pretty heavy mentions of it in Project 2025, which is a policy document drawn up by a conservative think tank, including a lot of members of Trump's first administration, which he has publicly distanced himself from. But that called basically for the complete gutting of CISA, for a lot of its roles to be transferred to the Transportation Department and for a real narrowing of its mission.
So there are a number of parties that have criticized CISA. What about corporate cyber executives? What does the business world have to say about CISA?
They're broadly pretty positive from the people I speak to, at least. CISA has done a lot over the last 4 years in particular to really boost its relationships with the private sector. It stood up this entity called the Joint Cyber Defense Collaborative, which is an interface between government, law enforcement, and the private sector, especially when things go wrong or there's a big event such as the Olympics or the Super Bowl or something like that, then they all get together and talk about it. They share intelligence through it. There have been some criticisms of CISA that they haven't perhaps been as effective as the private sector would like, but on the whole, the broad sentiment from most people I speak to is that they've done a pretty good job and their role is increasingly crucial at a time when threats from nation states, which have in the past been really the government's preserve, are now increasingly faced by corporations as well.
Last week, Trump appointed Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy to lead this new Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE. How could this potentially impact CISA?
CISA is kind of a ripe target for the kind of things that DOGE wants to do. Its budget has increased over the last year from $2 billion to $3 billion. It's hired pretty widely. the criticism from Republicans makes it seem like it does a lot more than its core mission. And some people we spoke to said that there might be a pause in new initiatives. There might be a pullback on existing ones just to make sure that, in their words, the mission is focused properly, which can mean anything from reductions in headcount through to cutbacks entirely.
Is there a risk that CISA might go away altogether?
There is always a risk, and Rand Paul, the senator from Kentucky I spoke about earlier, has said that he would like that in an ideal world, but even he admits it's unlikely. People we spoke to said that there are lawmakers on both sides of the House that would pretty much go to the mat for CISA. They understand its importance. And also CISA is so deeply embedded now in so many various parts of the federal government, it would be hard to extract it quickly. The risk is that we end up in a situation where we were maybe 8 years ago before CISA was even created, where there is no real coordination at the federal level, and every agency does their own thing. And as a result, you end up with chaos.
James, what has CISA said about all this?
CISA's remains diplomatic about this. A spokesman said the agency is fully committed to a seamless transition and left it there, in the same way that the Trump transition team said the American people re-elected President Trump by a resounding margin, giving him a mandate to implement the promises he made in the campaign trail. Everyone's waiting to see what happens. Although we do know some changes coming. Jenny Salee, the current director, said she will stand down on the day of President Trump's inauguration, as along with all other politically appointed officials. So that will herald a change at the top of the agency for sure.
That was our reporter, James Rundle. And that's it for Tech News Briefing. Today's show was produced by Julie Chang with supervising producer Catherine Millsop. Logging off, I'm Belle Lin for The Wall Street Journal. We'll sign back in this afternoon with TNB Tech Minute. Thanks for listening.